Joshua Cutchin with us as we talk about the strange supernatural child abductions, Thieves in the Night, a brief history of supernatural child abductions. More to come with your calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Joshua Cutchin with us. Josh, what happens to the changeling in time? Does it grow up to be an adult, and does it know what it is?
That's a great question. Typically, if the situation was left unaddressed, or if the changeling wasn't returned to the fairy world, which I'll address here in a moment, these changelings would die. It was quite miraculous for them to live past their early 20s. Although in some cases there are examples of people who were identified as changelings who actually ended up living to a much older age, and some of them would just live very strange lives. They would sort of rove the countryside and sort of appear as what we would, you know, interpret now as a village idiot. In some cases, there was a case of an individual who was allegedly a changeling who was born without any legs. Again, this is probably just a misinterpretation of a medical condition, who actually ended up being quite adept at sort of helping his family shepherd their flock. But in terms of much more common in these stories is this idea that somehow the changeling would be outed, as it were. The most common way to do this, there were several methods, including, you know, literally burning a child or baking it in an oven, or putting a hot poker, pressing a hot poker against its skin, or, beating it. Abuse was the most common method. The idea was that you would actually end up frightening the fairies for one of their own's well-being. So in other words, you would actually endanger the fairy, endanger the changeling, and the fairies would rush to its aid because they hated seeing one of their own kind mistreated. But the most common means of not only revealing whether or not you truly had a changeling, and one of the most common means of replacing your child, was this common motif that you see in a lot of different countries called the brewery of eggshells. And what this method really was all about was trying to make the changeling so surprised by some sort of nonsensical activity that it would remark how old it was. So the way that this usually played out was a mother would take, let's say, 24 eggshells, and she put a little bit of water in each one and set it beside the hearth. And the changeling would become interested in this activity and wonder what the heck was going on, because it was something it had never seen before. And eventually it would say, what are you doing, mother? And the mother would say, I'm making porridge. And the changeling would say something along the lines of, I've been around since before the oak was an acorn, but I've never seen something this ridiculous. Sometimes it depends on the region where people, would report that changelings would say, I've been around since this forest was a field, or I've been around since before this lake even formed, but I've never seen something so ridiculous. And at that point, the changeling would be called out for being a lot older than it appeared, because, again, remember, changelings were typically older fairy men. And it would be, having been called out, it would often flee, and the human child would be in its place. This motif of baffling the changeling with something nonsensical in order for it to reveal its age actually plays out in several different ways. Sometimes it would be, depending on the region, you would have people doing this brewery of eggshells method, using acorns or empty shellfish bits or something along those lines. But sometimes this idea, this motif of baffling the changeling, would express itself in different ways. So it was very common in some Scandinavian countries, instead of producing this pantomime of brewing porridge and eggshells, you would actually lash a bunch of rods together at the end of a spoon to create this giant spoon that, when you put it in the cauldron above the fire, would actually go all the way up the chimney, and the changeling would say, "What is that, mother?" And the mother would say, "Well, it's a spoon." And the changeling would say, "Well, I've been alive for 4,000 years, and I've never seen a spoon that long." And then again, the story would play itself out as it does with the brewery of eggshells method.
I've never heard stories of Bigfoot abducting kids. Have you?
It's something that I feel like the Bigfoot community doesn't quite like to talk about it as much as it is. But there are stories. Similar to this idea of extraterrestrials abducting people for their gametes, for their sperm and their egg. And fairy folk abducting children to sort of help incorporate themselves into the fairy bloodline. A lot of the Bigfoot stories that you find actually supposedly are detailed young women being taken for procreative purposes. But, you know, even setting that aside, there are actually quite a few stories that reference this. I mean, so if you look at one of the most popular terms for Bigfoot in the North American Southeast, booger, well, that comes from boogeyman. And boogeyman itself is a term that's actually a fairy term. It comes from the term bogey, bugbear. These are all sort of different types of fairies that inspire the term boogeyman. So right there you have sort of a germ, a sort of an inclination, a suggestion of something. But, you know, in a lot of First Nations lore in North America, you will find stories of these wild hairy men that like to take children. One of the Alaskan tribes, I believe it's the Kwakutl, actually claimed that there's this giant hairy ape woman of the woods, Dusnokwa, and she carries around this giant basket on her back, and she'll snatch up children and slap tree gum on their eyes and throw them in the basket on her back, which actually bears a strong resemblance to Russian tales of Baba Yaga.
Which is the boogeyman, right?
It's absolutely the boogeyman. Yeah. It absolutely is. And, you know, you also find in certain parts of the world, especially on the West Coast, this suggestion that if you were to walk highways alone as a child, you might actually be taken by, you know, the monkey man or by some sort of, you know, tall, hairy creature. And there's no shortage of actual, you know, cases. For example, I believe it was 1973. There's this flap of UFO and Bigfoot activity that happened at the same time in Pennsylvania, and there was a mother in Youngstown who actually reported a Sasquatch that was actually stalking her child and looked like it was about to grab it. You know, similarly, you'll find something from that same sort of, well, general part of the world, if not the same part of the country, of a 10-year-old girl in 1910 who was walking through the woods in Wisconsin was actually being, you know, sort of stalked by this hairy creature. And, you know, there's something that a lot of Bigfoot researchers have pointed out, which is this idea that Sasquatch definitely seems to be attracted or at least interested in children. The original sighting of the Missouri Monster, later known as Momo, was actually sighted by children who saw it staring at them while they played. So there is definitely a suggestion there that you might see this same spectrum of child abduction from Bigfoot.
If you're a parent, you got a child, would you be concerned listening to this broadcast tonight?
You know, I absolutely would. I think that there are probably more pressing concerns. You know, not to say that I don't think that these things have some sort of objective reality, but there are so many things to be frightened of nowadays that it is a concern. But, you know, I think that safeguarding your children against, I hesitate to say, sort of spiritual abduction or spiritual warfare, but safeguarding your children against non-human interference, I think, is something that's probably in everyone's best interest. And that might take the form of some sort of spiritual protection or, again, some sort of pragmatic protection. You know, I think that even if there is no objective reality to the idea that fairies are more active on misty, rainy days, it still stands as sort of an object lesson in terms of the sort of conditions that you should let your children go unsupervised, certainly.
All right, let's go to the phones. We'll go first to Jeff in Santa Rosa, California, to get things started for us. Hey, Jeffrey, go ahead.
How you doing, George?
Good.
Okay. Joshua, I would like to ask you about fairy mounds. So there was a daughter that I ran into, not my daughter, but somebody else's, years and years ago, whose mother was in Ireland, and she found a fairy mound out in this area where she was walking. She just saw it out there. It had never been there before. So she went to look at it, and it had an opening, and she walked into it, which apparently, according to the Irish legends, you're not supposed to go into these fairy mounds. And she ended up being in another land, is the way her daughter described it. And I'm sorry, I don't remember all of the details, like where it was or exactly what she went through. Your talk reminded me of this story that I'd completely forgotten about. But she was gone for months. I want to say about 7 months.
Wow.
And, yeah, it was a long time. And she got back. I don't remember exactly how she got back, but her daughter said she escaped, and she came back to her own time without any missing time at all. And she went home. She was young when that happened, and she went home, and then she told people what happened to her, and she went back out to the ferry mound. I guess it was the next day, and it was gone. It was one of those things that just appeared and disappeared. So I was wondering if you could speak about ferry mounds. You seem very versed, and you appear to be the appropriate person to talk to because you're so well knowledgeable about these kind of things.
Well, thank you so much. And everything that you said is absolutely folklorically and anecdotally right on point. So for anybody who doesn't know, ferry mounds, which are generally considered rafts, Leos, Duns, ferry forts, these are all sort of the same collection of structures, are basically littering the Irish landscape. By some estimates, it's 60,000 different sort of ferry sites in Ireland. Again, you're talking about a space the size of Indiana. So you're literally never far from a ferry fort or some sort of ferry structure. Again, that what I said earlier about this connection between ferries and the dead sometimes makes it difficult to parse out. These ferry structures are very unambiguously human-created, but at the same time, they have this association with the ferries, which begs to ask what exactly ferries are. But again, to your point, many of these, especially ones that were burial mounds, human burial mounds that later were associated with the ferries, have these passageways, which are called souterrains. And these souterrains are, some archaeologists suspect that they were actually for storing dried goods and resources, but the others feel that they were actually a means of escape in terms of, you know, if the human settlement was invaded. But this is the reason that we see the motif of fairyland always being underground, the idea that the fairies lived in these fairy forts and would actually travel into these underground tunnels to go to, as you mentioned, fairyland. And I actually talked to an individual in Ireland who found sort of a fairy chapel in a hill, but you had to sort of look at it in a very specific way. So it also speaks to this idea that your friend wasn't able to really sort of relocate the way that she went under to fairyland. Another thing that really rings true in that story is this motif of compressed or missing time. I mean, it's one of the things a lot of people who draw connections between the alien abduction contact experience and fairy lore points to is that they say, well, you know, in the modern abduction experience, you have people who feel like they were away for, you know, an hour, or, you know, their car ride home shouldn't have only taken 30 minutes and it took them 4 hours or something. We often find that in fairy lore quite a bit, except it's a little bit looser in fairy lore. You know, sometimes it would be people thought that they were away for a very short time, and they actually came back hundreds of years later, and they would eat their first food, and they would turn into dust. Or also common, which seems to be what your friend was expressing, was this idea that sometimes people would feel like they were away for forever and they would come back the same night. This was really common for musicians to go away and supposedly play a fairy funeral or a fairy wedding and feel like they were gone for, again, months at a time, and they would return within a very short space of time. So all that rings very, very true. And, you know, I find it really interesting how vibrant fairy lore still is in that part of the world, and how people still respect those traditions, even if they don't. I had somebody tell me when I was over there back in October, they said, I don't believe in fairies, but I'm scared of them. And that's sort of a perfect summation of belief in that part of the world, which I find really charming and really, it really excites me.
Joe in Long Island. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, hi. I'm not going to watch The Changeling after listening.
No.
but in terms of the derivation of all this, I was thinking maybe Atlantis Island could have been on the outskirts of Atlantis. That would be one idea. Another would be the Romans that did come in did practice a lot of dark arts, magic, in conjunction with the Egyptian culture that melded into there. That could be maybe another derivation. And also the Celtic music, I'm wondering if has a conjuring force as well. And I know they supposedly, the fairies have, can interject their powers into actual natural events. I'm wondering if they were blamed for the potato famine at the time.
Yeah, so there's a lot of different things to unpack. To your last point, yes, there are some people that felt that the very specific blight of the Great Potato Famine was attributed to fairy folk. You know, in reality, it was sort of a constellation of political problems. You know, the idea that Ireland had plenty of food, it just wasn't making its way to the mouths of the people, is basically sort of where it went with in terms of England exporting crops and whatnot. But yeah, you're absolutely right. The any sort of blight or sort of problems around the farm would be blamed on the fairy folk. this idea of music, I think, is really important, because you'll find in a lot of these fairy stories, the first inclination that you are near the fair folk is that you'll actually hear their sound of their music twinkling, you know, sort of on the breeze.
But no tuba playing.
No tuba playing, unfortunately. Huh. Although I think there is a Terrence McKenna anecdote where he recalls having a DMT trip and hearing a tuba playing elf.
Could you imagine seeing a fairy play a tuba?
Oh, Lord. But, you know, I think that these ideas of music and these ideas of contact with the other world and these ideas of altered states are all very much tied into one thing, and music is a very important part of fairy lore. This idea of this ethereal music that compels you to dance as well is something that you see time and time again, and is often used as sort of a lure. I mean, something I go through in the book is the idea of different lures to draw children out towards the woods. And sometimes it was just as simple as calling the child's name, and sometimes it was something a little bit more compelling like music. And
mm-hmm.
I think that in a lot of ways you are right to perceive this as having a spiritual, non-physical component. I think that you're absolutely on point with that.
Let's go to Tom with a text or tweet back in the studio. Tom, what do you have?
Hey, Joshua, this is from Carmen in Santa Rosa. Can you ask your guest, she says, if he can talk about duendes?
Oh, yes, the duende.
That's like is it Mexican or Spanish? Little fairy-type creature, right?
Well, one of the interesting things about fairy lore is that it tends to be exported with its immigrants. So the main reason that you find a lot of, you will find old world fairies in the northeastern part of the U.S. is because they sort of came over with people from the British Isles as well. And probably the most successful fairy export was the duende, which actually came from Iberia. It was this more specifically probably a Portuguese sort of fairy folk. And they ended up being brought over to not only Latin America, but also the Philippines and the Mariana Islands. So anywhere that the people from that particular part of the world ended up, is they brought this duende tradition with them. And again, you'll find these motifs of child abduction as well. They tended to love abducting children who were yet to be baptized, so there's that motif again, and also women who were not quite wed. And in order to accomplish this, they would use hypnotism, or you give them little gifts, or perhaps, you know, say sweet words into the ears, whisper sweet words in the ears of these unwed women. And also to sort of accomplish this, they would lurk around homes and rural villages or schools, most unsettlingly enough. The duende tradition is another sort of vibrant fairy tradition that survived that transition across the ocean from the old world to the new world. And it's very much part of this constellation, absolutely.
As we return in just a second, Josh, for final phone calls, would you tell folks where they can get your book, Thieves in the Night?
Absolutely. It is available on... Well, hopefully, if you can get it from a brick-and-mortar store, do that. But it's also available from Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com.
Amazon has them all. They just surpassed $1 trillion in market value. Can you believe that?
That train is not stopping anytime soon, that's for sure.
And he started off selling books.
I know. It's really fascinating to me that it's a book retailer that now sells everything under the sun. It's wild.
It really is. Josh, we're going to come back and take final phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program for the first couple hours, Robert Young Pelton joins us to talk about some world events. Then Marshall Masters talks with us about Planet X. Is it out there in the solar system? You just never know. We're back with Joshua Cutchin, of course, is author of the book Thieves in the Night. Josh, what's the reported oldest channeling or person who was abducted? The oldest?
Well, hands down, the earliest changeling story that we have still is the story of this young girl, of all things, named by the name of Malakin was her name. So, again, one of the few stories that we actually have detailing a girl who's been taken by the fairy folks, and that was in the 13th century. There was this author, Ralph of Coggeshall, who composed this, who compiled this story called Chronicon Anglicanum. And in this case, it was this voice that was inhabiting Dagworthy Castle in Suffolk in England that claimed that she had been taken by the fairies 7 years ago and would return to the human world in 7 years' time. Of course, that's the story of a child taken by the fairies, and it kind of sounds like a poltergeist case because it's just a disembodied voice in a castle. So that's not entirely it's not entirely an answer to your question. However, in the 13th century, William of Auvergne, a philosophical theologian who was actually the Bishop of Paris, mentioned one of the earliest changeling stories, and in a document that he authored. He actually used the term cambio, which is from the Latin term cambiti, which means to be exchanged. And in that case, he described these cases of mothers who had their children substituted with the spawn of incubi demons. So that's really sort of the earliest we see that changeling story starting to form up.
Has there ever been a report of an abducted child escaping and you see the child and the changeling, you know, next to each other?
Rarely. That's something that I find really interesting, which sort of ties into my thesis in the book, is that whenever a child was returned and the changeling taken back to the fairyland, almost in every single case I've found, parents will, like, turn their back on the child for a moment, or they will, you know, they'll just have the changeling will be just out of sight, and then when they look again, their human child is returned. Similarly, you know, in cases where the changeling was beaten, until the human child was returned, sometimes it will happen right as they're, you know, they'll actually be holding the child and beating it, and suddenly all of a sudden it'll be better, which I think tends to suggest that what we're looking at isn't really necessarily a physical exchange, but perhaps something non-physical. One of the primary scholars on fairy folklore, Walter Evans Wentz, was quite enamored with the idea that perhaps we were looking actually at some sort of possession case when you have these changeling cases, and the idea that this sort of trauma might actually shock the possessing spirit out of the human's body and the human spirit back into the body.
Let's go to the phones. Bill in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hey, Bill, go ahead.
Hi, George. Good to talk to you again. You met me in your Scottsville invasion back in April.
As a matter of fact, I'm going to be back there in September for the Afterlife Symposium.
I'm going to try and make that one, too. But my question for your guest is about 18 years ago now, I took an anthropology class in college, and I wanted to get his opinion on what he thought about the Native American Southwest belief that the spirits of the cacti would come to life in the middle of the night and spirit your child away.
Did you ever hear of that, Josh?
Yeah, although that particular, there is no shortage of these stories of entities taking children from all across the globe. But one of the cacti spirits specifically is actually new to me, so thank you for bringing that to my attention. But it definitely seems part and parcel with a lot of these concepts of these fairy folk in terms of the British Isles being what we would call genus loci, spirits of place. The idea that these entities are somehow attached to the land. I mean, that ties in part with the idea of, like, what the heck were the fairies to begin with. Most of the times, it seems like they were sort of pagan entities of the landscape that were sort of Christianized and pushed out after Christianity was introduced to the British Isles. But it's definitely part and parcel, with that motive of these land spirits taking children away. It's really interesting to see how a lot of these Native American myths actually end up paralleling fairy myths. For example, motivically speaking, it's really interesting that whirlwinds in the Middle East and, as I mentioned, you know, in Ireland, but also amongst the Hopi, were all seen as places where you could actually lose your child. Pregnant women, both in the Middle East and in certain Native American cultures, were warned to not step into whirlwinds because they were the manner in which witches and other elemental spirits who were seeking to steal children would sort of navigate the landscape. So it definitely seems like we're dealing with some sort of objective supernatural reality that a bunch of different cultures are describing. Absolutely.
Next up, we've got Daniel west of the Rockies in Concord, California. Hey, Daniel, go ahead.
Hi. My great-grandmother was born in Ireland, and her name was Fae, which is Gaelic for fairy. And I was wondering, why would the Irish name a little baby girl Fae?
That's a great question, because, you know, in a lot of these cultures...
It's a nice name.
Yeah, well, I actually, there's someone that my wife knows from her childhood who's actually, her name was, her actual first name was Fairy itself. It's interesting. You know, the actual term fairy was oftentimes never spoken. It was always, you know, the good folk or the fair folk or the gentry or the wee folk. You wouldn't really necessarily even want to say the name fairy. So it is really interesting that that she would actually be named that. There are a couple of different reasons why that might be the case. For example, if you look at the Welsh version of the fairies, the Tylwyth Teg, that actually means the fair family when you translate it. So this idea of fairness, of sort of fair complexion, is all tied into that sort of the etymology, the root word of that term. I would suspect, I mean, if you look at when fairy belief started to really die out in the British Isles in terms of being taken seriously as a day-to-day reality, it's around that sort of 1900 turn of the century time frame. So perhaps the sort of stigma had been alleviated. Of course, you know, another option which which might be interesting to pursue in terms of, you know, your own lineage is to it was entirely possible that some people believe that people in their family were actually born of the fairies, that their mother or father had actually fathered or mothered a fairy child with one of the fair folks. And so in that case, it wouldn't be any sort of stigma at all to name your child Fae.
Text or tweets, our final one. What do you have, Tom, for us?
Joshua, this is from Terry in Los Angeles. Do fairies have brains like we have brains? Can they reason?
Oh, I think they can. What do you think, Josh? Thanks, Tom.
Well, I mean, it sort of depends on what fairies are. If you believe that there's some sort of, you know, physical reality, like they're literally little people running around, I'd say that, they, of course, they probably do have brains. But even in that case, if you look at some of the fairy literature, for example, specifically I'm thinking of Robert Kirk, who wrote The Secret Commonwealth of Fairies, Scottish priest who sort of authored one of the earliest extant documents on the phenomena. He actually claimed that the fairies' own actual physical reality was much more lighter and etheric. Kirk actually compared it to being more spongy. In my way that I've currently interpreted a lot of these myths, I think that there's a real non-physicality to this phenomena. So a physical brain, in terms of what I can see, no, but a consciousness, absolutely, because I think that a lot of the research nowadays in a lot of areas of science is pointing to the reality that consciousness is sort of a fundamental constant of the universe.
Doug in New Jersey's with us now. Hey, Doug, go ahead.
Yes, thank you for having me on.
Sure.
Very interesting show. I was wondering, is this still going on today? I mean, is there people who believe their children are being substituted with a elemental or a doppelganger or whatever you'd like to call it? And if so, is there a test they could do, maybe a blood test for DNA or anything like that to see if there's any kind of a physiological change that might have taken place during this?
Well, that's a great question. In terms of, you know, people are still having fairy sightings today. In terms of the actual changeling story manifesting itself, you don't really see it. I mean, granted, there are some people alive today, some older generations in Ireland, who claim to remember a changeling in their past, but you don't see that really manifesting itself unless you interpret the sort of alien contact experience, as I do, as a reinvention of a lot of these older stories. In which case, I mean, yeah, we have a lot of different stories of children being taken, and, you know, if you can even interpret, you know, one of the ways that you can reinterpret the, you know, the modern alien abduction lore, one of the ways you can interpret the indigo child phenomenon, this idea of these children who are star children or indigo children who are, you know, half alien, half human, and actually live among us. That has all the earmarks and all the motifs of changelings as well, except it's sort of an inversion of that motif. In other words, the perfect child is living here amongst us, but the humans are the changelings in that case. But again, it's this idea of this child of the other world walking amongst us. I find some really interesting parallels between indigo children and, as I mentioned, these human fairy hybrids that you used to see in this earlier lore, because the human fairy hybrids were always gifted with the arts and were always quite intelligent. And that's something that you see in Indigo Children / Star Children stories.
Josh, well, at what point does a parent realize that his child has been switched?
Well, I mean, typically it would be whenever they were being cantankerous. I mean, that was the thing, is there was always a regressive quality to these child exchange stories, where the child would actually become suddenly unpleasant after being pleasant. And again, you see that as, you know, a sort of the indigo child motif being a mirror image of the changeling, because the indigo children in these cases are actually quite pleasant. The question of, like, a blood test, as our guest or as our caller mentioned, is a great point, and it's something that, as much sympathy and as much love and as much of a reality as I realize that the alien abduction experience is, there needs to be more work in terms of establishing some baseline blood work, DNA work amongst these individuals. And I think that if there truly is something physically going on, a blood test would prove that. At the same time, I think that there really is a non-physical component to this that I'm not entirely sure blood work would really reveal anything.
First-time caller Netra in Indiana is with us now. Hi, Netra. Go ahead.
Hi. It's great to be on your show.
You love too, it. Sir.
I've been
Thank
following you.
You
guys for over 2 years now.
Thank you.
I'll keep this short and sweet because you guys are running out of time. I actually believe that at birth, which I was unfortunately had to be C-section, that I actually unfortunately flatlined multiple times on the table. I honestly believe that my original spirit actually ended up leaving, and basically that's how I ended up being replaced. Yeah, so, and I was of course raised as a child, as a human child. Later on, got diagnosed with schizophrenia. Turns out my doctor ended up actually seeing some of the fae that had followed me around. I ended up being discharged. I was like, it basically went on to serve in the military and everything. And that was not on my record. And I'd seen this doctor for years. But I honestly believe that that's most of the time how fae end up actually either taking on a human form and becoming what is considered a changeling.
Jeez, so you're a changeling.
Yes.
In terms of your body parts, in your heart and kidneys, they're all the same?
All the same. like I look like a normal person. The only difference is, it's not necessarily a thing of some people, they're like, oh, I sense the fae, or I thought I saw something. It's like, no. Like, if there's a fae in a room, I'm looking, I can see them, almost as if, like, I could walk up and just, like, I could literally put my hand, like, right over top of where they're standing.
Do you feel human?
Show up. Huh?
Do you feel like a human being?
I'm not exactly how that exactly feels.
Yeah, well, that's a good question.
Honest. But like, I think I feel, like, just fine. But, like, as far as things like thought, my thought sounds more feminine. It sounds nothing like how I actually speak.
All right, Josh, a minute and a half left. What do you think of that?
First of all, I'm envious of your ability to perceive these things. I think that you're touching on a very important subject, which is this concept of, you know, walk-ins and what sort of role that sort of, again, for lack of a better term, almost sort of possession plays. And I think that you really are quite on point with that. I suspect that a lot of times when we see certain things that we would classify as mental illness or whatnot, that we really are perceiving, at least in some cases, some sort of other world interacting with us. I mean, it lines up quite nice with the idea that some of these changeling stories are actually misrecognized medical conditions. So I think that something can be a medical condition, and it can have an extra normal, for lack of a better term, reality as well, 100%.
Joshua, give out your websites, if you would.
Yes, it's joshuacutchin.com, joshuacutchin.com. I have a blog that I keep there. You can hear me on sort of a semi-weekly basis, Where Did the Road Go? I'm a roundtable guest on there regularly. And finally, my books, Trojan Feast, The Brimstone Deceit, and Thieves in the Night are all available via your favorite online retailer. Just type in Joshua Cutchin, and there are plenty of options to choose from.
Josh, keep in touch with us. Come on back, okay?
An absolute pleasure, George. Thank you so much for having me on.
What a great guest, and what a frightening topic. My God, to imagine that your child's been replaced by a duplicate. Wow. For Nathan Staton, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galante, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasor, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Banal, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.